I think the common philosophy is that you need to unlock a new way of communicating that wasn't possible before. So right. like probably the most common example of this is Snapchat's like ephemerality model.
Right.
In our case, we actually kind of made an active decision not to really try to seek that out as the main differentiator for Cocoon, but to think about the relationship as the differentiator.
From 2003 Media, this is The Ones Who Succeed. I'm Campbell Barron. Welcome to the program.
I'm Sachin Manga. I am one of the co-founders and CEO of Cocoon. Cocoon is a mobile app that we launched a little over a year ago. And we are really trying to explore what a sort of futuristic, modern, digital home base for a close-knit group might look like.
Today on the show, I'm thrilled to have a conversation with Sachin Manga. Sachin is the co-founder and CEO of this super interesting consumer social app called Cocoon that is essentially a digital home base for tight-knit groups like family members and close friends. Embedded into the interface are all kinds of thoughtful features like a flight tracker widget and group calls that all really work well together. In my humble opinion, Cocoon is a stunning app. It's really well designed and thought out. Furthermore, it's an ambitious app. The world of consumer social is super crowded, not to mention, I wouldn't wish competing with Facebook on my worst enemy. So, how do you stay alive, then thrive in this crowded world of consumer social mobile? That is what I want to break down in this episode. That's right ahead. My conversation with Sachin Manga starts now. Cocoon is a very, very well designed and thought out app. It's actually one of my favorites from a aesthetic perspective. So great work to you and your team there. But I figured we would start back in 2009, before Cocoon, before California, because okay. I read that you were an operational architect for the Department of National Defense. That's not exactly what I would have assumed to kind of be your first gig on your LinkedIn profile. So what was taking place in your life at that time? And what was your, I guess, entry point into tech?
Yeah, okay, wow. Well, I was a student at the University of Waterloo. I studied systems design engineering, which is a co-op program where you do 4 months of school, 4 months of work, and you just alternate for 5 years. And that was my first co-op job. So I was an intern, a co-op student at the Department of National Defense was building a new headquarters, and they needed to like figure out, there's so many different teams that interact with each other, and they needed to, it was a pretty mundane project, really. They just needed to figure out who should sit in this new building, basically. But it was a fun first job. I think the big takeaway maybe was that I probably would be a really bad government employee. And the nice thing with Waterloo's co-op system is you can figure that out in 4 months instead of many years, which maybe it would have taken otherwise.
Fair enough. And was your mindset at this time, even at Waterloo, was it, I'm going to, you know, work at a couple companies and then start my own? When did the entrepreneurial kind of bug hit you?
Yeah, my time at Waterloo, I think I kind of think of it now as like maybe in sort of computer science engineering terms, like a breadth first search. Like my whole plan was to try as many different things as possible, kind of coming in with the assumption that how would I know at age 17 what I wanted to spend the rest of my life on? I never really felt like I was one of those entrepreneurs that felt like they had to start a company or had to be doing their own thing or wanted to be their own boss or whatever it was. I kind of just wanted to like explore a lot. And usually the way this worked was I would do a thing and be like, okay, cool. Like, I don't want to do that, but this gave me an idea for maybe something that I might want to try. So from the government, I ended up kind of catching the finance bug and wanted to work at Bank of Montreal, did that mm-hmm. next. And then I worked at a startup and bounced around, and here I am.
And in 2011, you got a job at Facebook, I guess it's yep. Facebook Canada. This is in Toronto. And then in 2018, you were there, you ultimately stayed at Facebook until 2018. So I guess my first question is, what was Facebook like? And I think this is relevant because you ultimately later on with Cocoon, you're building a product in a very similar space. So what was Facebook like in 2011?
Facebook was unlike anything I had ever experienced. And obviously I had a pretty narrow window of experience at that point, only really three jobs for 4 months each. But joining Facebook at that time was very much like drinking from a fire hose. I think I've heard that analogy a bunch. And it's one of the few times that for me, I think it really truly rings true. Yeah, it was a crazy, chaotic time where I think Facebook was just transitioning from being a thing that like wasn't clearly going to work to being something that was going to clearly work, but that comes with it a bunch of new problems and growing pains and opportunities. And I think, yeah, if you look at Facebook in probably like 2009, 2010, there were all sorts of big questions that now seem kind of funny in retrospect, but like, can Facebook ever make money? Or like, how are they going to handle
the shift
to mobile?
Wow.
Yeah. So it was a fun time to join because I think there are very few situations probably where you can kind of experience that exact shift. And I felt very lucky to get to experience it. And kind of going back to the Waterloo thing, it felt very much like an extension of that. Like I stayed for 7 years because I basically had like 8 or 9 different jobs, different roles, different functions, totally different product areas to work on. And it was just like a pretty crazy experience to get to learn so quickly from so many different people and get to work on so many different things.
So, well, let's get to Cocoon now, because I obviously want to dive into this. I think one of the interesting things with the platform or with the product, from my opinion, is that it kind of does a lot. And a lot of the key selling points, if you will, are very subtle. So with that, your family is spread out. Your co-founder's family is spread out. So my question here is, what wasn't an iMessage or WhatsApp or Facebook group chat doing that you felt there was a hole in the market that you could essentially solve with Cocoon?
Yeah. That's a great question. It really came down to, if you look at some of the research on what makes relationships strong, there's a lot of pretty compelling evidence that it's having a lot of lightweight interactions regularly, frequently, over a really long period of time. Mm-hmm. And so even just little things like saying good morning, or making eye contact, or just knowing a little bit about what's going on in that person's day. Did they have a good day or did they have a bad day? These are the types of things that flow really naturally when you all live together, of course, right? Like whether you like it or you're not, if your sister comes home, she's having a bad day, you're just going to know. These are the types of things that are especially impossible to share over something like iMessage or WhatsApp. And the reason being is that everything that you share in a messaging app has to be text worthy, has to be worthy of blowing up everyone's phones who's on that thread, has to be worthy of generating response. It's going to basically interrupt this single linear flow of information that we've got going on. And so what falls in the cracks is anything that's not text worthy, that doesn't necessarily warrant an urgent response right away. We used to joke when we were talking about this in the beginning that even something as simple as like texting good morning to someone, like that, like every family and every friend group and every group chat has its own culture. And I know that there are for sure many chat threads or relationships where you can just like text 10 people a good morning and that won't be considered strange. But I wasn't in a group chat like that, I'll tell you, right? Like there were so many different emotions that might elicit, like it might be like confusion, like, are you okay? Like what's going on?
Right.
My mom, a bit of an aha moment for me was that my mom would basically never text me during the day and would rarely text me at all. And when I asked her about this, she would always just be like, oh, I don't want to interrupt you. You're working. Like, I don't want to be kind of in your face or anything. That kind of just struck me as like a little bit sad. And so, to answer your question, there's sort of two questions in there. One is like, what does it do? There's basically nothing that you can do in Cocoon that you can't literally do elsewhere. There are formats that kind of we have that are a bit unique and push the boundaries a little bit. Like, for example, we have this automated flight tracker, which is a pretty common thing for especially families. You'll always get the, hey, text when you land and text when you take off and that kind of thing. So we've like built a much more compelling and automated and useful experience around a loved one traveling. But of course you literally could like text your mom when you land, and you literally could look up the flight number. And it's not like we really provided insight into information that didn't exist before. Mm-hmm. Again, it's not like you literally can't text a picture of my dog doing a funny thing. It's more like, will I do that? And if not, like, what is the downside for our relationship if we don't get anything that isn't urgent and text worthy? So that's one way we've thought about it. The second thing that you mentioned I thought was really interesting too, which is sort of that it's not necessarily like, it's a lot of little subtle upgrades and it's sort of a composite of a bunch of different formats.
Yeah,
we think about this a lot because it's actually a very active decision. Most social apps or messaging apps, I think the common philosophy is that you need to unlock a new way of communicating that wasn't possible before. So like probably the most common example of this is Snapchat's like ephemerality model.
Right.
In our case, we actually kind of made an active decision not to really try to seek that out as the main differentiator for Cocoon, but to think about the relationship as the differentiator. So for people that you actively want to be spending more time with, you want to be sharing more of your life with, you want to know more about them, how could we remove all of the barriers to information and awareness flowing just for those people? And because we can make some assumptions around the types of relationships that you're using Cocoon with, we can kind of push all of the normal formats like photo sharing and messaging and video calling into a extreme that would be really hard for any other app to do because they can't make those same assumptions. Mm-hmm. So our video calling is a lot more intimate. If you're in a group of five people and two people are talking live, everyone else will know and they can drop in if they want. It doesn't ring anyone's phone. It's sort of like a unique take on that. Same with messaging, photo sharing, and every other format.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's really well said. And again, it all kind of ties in together. But I'd have to imagine the flight tracking feature so relevant a year ago. I'm sure that's pretty.
Yeah, we launched it. No joke. I think I was looking at the logs. We launched it like in mid February. I think like or 3 weeks before everything went down.
It will bounce back eventually. So that's my next question, which is Cocoon. I think I first heard about it perhaps in January. The world has dramatically changed, but arguably in Cocoon's case, I would see that the use cases, because you're in San Francisco, I take it you're not actively flying back and forth back to Toronto to see your parents. And so there's kind of a heightened desire for connection. Walk me through or talk me through how Cocoon is doing right now in a world where COVID-19 is still here. Coming up on The Ones Who Succeed, I continue my conversation with Sachin from Cocoon. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to the program and my conversation with Sachin Manga. Walk me through or talk me through how Cocoon is doing right now in a world where COVID-19, is still here.
Yeah. I mean, we launched Cocoon, I think it was basically two months before, it was like end of November 2019. So mm-hmm. 2-3 months before everything hit the roof. And it was a pretty intense sort of flurry. I think those few weeks we were kind of like, oh man, like is our products, like it seems like on the surface level that it should be even more relevant and more useful, and like, but if like, why exactly, what are the features, or what are the use cases that are kind of becoming more important, and is there anything that became kind of less important? And it was a bit of a shuffle, and we kind of like let the dust settle, and then we talked to tons of people who were using the product, and a bunch of our prior assumptions I think just got smashed, which was a really fun exercise because we had to have a lot of humility, and we really just listened to how people were using the product. And we found that maybe like 20 or 30% of our assumptions were like sound and maybe stronger, probably like 30 or 40. Maybe it was like an even split, a third, a third, a third. A third of the assumptions were totally wrong. One of them being that this was a product only for families. And what we realized was the common thread that bound a lot of the groups that were finding success in Cocoon was not necessarily that they were like long distance families, which was sort of the persona archetype that we had in mind, what we built for and what we were really looking to solve for ourselves. There were lots of friend groups, there were a lot of couples, mm-hmm. even like support groups and coaching circles, and just sort of like a wide range of different types of groups using it. And at first that kind of threw us off because we were like, oh, we were like kind of trying to build the family app. And that was like a pretty useful North Star. We could just be like, what do families want? And we could talk to families. And losing that was a little bit difficult, to be honest. But what we discovered, I think, from talking to a lot of people, that the common thread actually tied back to that thing I mentioned at the beginning, which was the way that relationships get stronger is through lots of lightweight interaction over time. It's through more awareness, more information mm-hmm. flowing mm-hmm. amongst the members. And that was basically what people were using Cocoon for, was to just get more from each other and to share more than they could have in sort of these two extreme poles. A social network like a Facebook or Instagram, where the reason you can't share more is because now everything you share has to be relevant to like everyone. So that's going to vastly limit how much you can share. Mm-hmm. And then in messaging apps, it solves that sort of like audience problem, but there are all sorts of new barriers, like we talked about, around sort of this single urgent thread and synchronicity and notifications and organization. And you had a good point too, of just mixing everyone in that one audience, in that one space. And so that was sort of what we realized, was we were in the business of smashing down barriers for sharing. In the COVID world, that became, that kind of took on a very different lens because there were new types of things that were important to share. So we did a big release around a pretty deep health kit integration, allowing people to share their workouts and exercise and meditation, like mindfulness activity, even their heart rate and their body temperature. If you were using like a health kit enabled thermometer, that was a pretty important sprint in early on in COVID times. The synchronicity element became pretty important. So we added this group audio video call. It really did kind of shape our roadmap by just kind of asking people, like, what are the things you want to be sharing more of that you find difficult to share with a text thread? And that really guided our roadmap for the first few months after COVID.
Mm-hmm. Are you in a better spot than you were a year ago?
It's hard to know. I think you can't really like A/B test these things. I think the way I frame it is that let's say there were like a set of things we needed to learn about what Cocoon wanted to be when it grew up. And in a no COVID world, it may have taken us a year to figure that out or 2 years or something. I think it accelerated our learning by a lot. Mm-hmm. So by that measure, I think probably we are, I'm grateful for that. That was a bit of a silver lining, but I think there were some apps that just like went from zero to like hundreds of millions of downloads, and Cocoon was definitely not that. It also kind of helped us though understand our virality a little bit better and our growth model. We always kind of had a hunch that Cocoon would grow in a very different way than a typical social or messaging app, given the network constraints. And right. So that was really instructive. We had just launched the ability to be in multiple Cocoons right before COVID. And so we could kind of start to see that play out. And our virality is also, it happens on a much longer time period. So in a typical app, you kind of like sign up, you immediately follow people who are already in the app, and then you start using it. And then pretty quickly, you'll like probably invite a bunch of people. Right. In our case, you sign up, there's no indication that anyone else is using this app, unless you were invited to a Cocoon. But for what we call kind of pioneers who sign up, who maybe hear about Cocoon and want to try it out, they sign up, they have to create a Cocoon, they invite people. Hopefully they can get those people on board and they get assembled. And then at some point in the future, the handful of people I've gotten my first Cocoon might go on to create new Cocoons. But that happens on a much longer time horizon. So we are just starting to see that play out now. And yeah, so I guess to answer your question, I don't know, but it definitely accelerated our learning.
Mm-hmm. And how much money have you raised thus far?
We've raised around $3 million total so far.
Did J.Cal ever get on your cap table?
We never raised any more money after our seed. So I guess the answer is no.
Yeah, staying.
Although that was a very funny moment, I will say.
Oh, it's hilarious. Yeah, some of my friends who listen to that show still think, bring it up. I think it's pretty funny. Okay, so building a social app in 2020. I actually think, interestingly enough, I think 2020 was a year where a lot more happened in social than I guess in previous years. You know, that is likely due to the pandemic. But just aside from Clubhouse, TikTok started gaining some serious market share. And I think really before TikTok, Facebook really was kind of the lone soldier. Going into Cocoon, I guarantee you everyone and their pet dog told you that social is the hardest, or consumer social. I know you're not building a social network, but just an app that has social element, right? Consumer social, probably one of the hardest spaces to break into. And there are apps that have done super, super well, like Yik Yak, that are here today, gone tomorrow. Mm-hmm. There are apps that maybe like Clubhouse that stay around, or like TikTok, right? Or Musical.ly that stay around. But it's very, 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 very difficult to break through. So how did you approach building in this space?
Yeah.
In a world where the app store is pretty crowded.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I actually thought about this in a pretty different way, I think, than maybe one might think given what we built. So it was, I have the story now of my parents and Alex, my co-founder, and his family, and us kind of like sort of bottoms up coming to this problem as something that felt like we were really compelled to work on. Mm-hmm. We didn't actually start though here. We were both working at Facebook. We were working together on a bunch of things. We enjoyed working together. We decided we would leave and strike out on our own and try to build something, but we didn't know, it wasn't Cocoon at that moment. We didn't know what we were going to do. The sort of spark of an idea, if we had one, had nothing to do with social or with any particular product. It was an observation with how people use their time. And I think this is actually a pretty instructive thing when you mentioned TikTok too. I'll get back to that in a sec.
Yeah.
Which is that a relatively new phenomenon that didn't exist at all 10 years ago, or maybe like 12 years ago now, is finding yourself with a little gap in your day and actually being able to channel that into anything in the world that you want. And before, if you had a little gap in your day, if you were sitting in the back of a taxi or if you were standing in line somewhere, you would just be standing in line or sitting in a taxi. Like you wouldn't have access to all of the world's information and every single person on the planet like instantly and for free. And now we do. And I don't think we as a society had really like grappled with that yet. And one of the indicators was that even though it seems like we have all of these different options of things we could do in that little 1 minute gap, we basically only had one actual channel, which was scrolling through an endless jar of other people's content without really knowing what you were going to get. And I think that was actually really instructive to us, was that it found it was pretty interesting and almost funny to think about the fact that I might scroll through Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or whatever it is, and I don't know if I'm going to be reading an article a minute later or laughing at a joke or seeing an update about a friend, or like it's literally like this crazy grab bag of I have no idea what I'm going to get. And we thought that that was sort of like there was an opportunity here, because I don't think people are like robots who are just like, feed me like an IV of content. I don't care what it is. I think people are a lot more intentional about those, like have the capacity to be a lot more intentional about those moments. And if you look at something like a Facebook or an Instagram compared to a TikTok, it's really striking how different they actually are. I don't even consider TikTok a social network in any way, shape, or form. It's a pure, unbridled entertainment feed. And there are social elements, because there's going to be social elements to everything. But you can be very entertained with TikTok without ever signing up for an account, creating a profile, following people, having followers. Remove all of the social elements of TikTok, and it's just a pure entertainment machine that is much more highly entertaining than anything on Facebook or Instagram in terms of just like entertainment density. And so with when you kind of think about social in 2020, I kind of think about it as a little bit of this sort of like unbundling to the extremes. And I think the reason is people can be intentional. I have 2 minutes and I want to accomplish X. In Cocoon's case, it's like, I want to see what's going on with my closest people, and Cocoon should be a much more efficient vehicle for helping me do that than like opening up Facebook or Instagram and seeing maybe that someone happened to do a thing that I find relevant. TikTok, obviously, extreme entertainment. I think there's opportunities for other extremes as well.
I had Tim Kendall on the show, who was when it featured in The Social Dilemma. And one of the things we were discussing is just this idea of kind of constant dopamine hits. So it seems like your approach was different than building an app like TikTok or building an app like Facebook. I've got that. Nevertheless, the end game is you still want people to use the app, stick around. But before all of that, you want people to download it. And in that sense, you're competing in a world where, you know, there's the App Store and it's still prominent, but it is very crowded. How did you look at building a mobile app where you're really competing with tons and tons of different services? How did you think about building in just that, like from an App Store perspective specifically? All right, we're going to take one last quick break and we'll be right back with Sachin Manga. That's right ahead. Stay with us. Welcome back to the program and my conversation with Sachin Manga. How did you think about building in just that, like from an App Store perspective specifically?
Sure. Like the answer in terms of how we thought about this in the beginning was we didn't. I don't think we had any master plan of App Store optimization or SEO hacking or anything like that. Our approach here was we started by basically recruiting beta testers. And the nice thing with an app like Cocoon is it's not that hard to find people for whom this might be relevant. So our first Cocoons were literally like my family and Alex's family. And and then, you know,
you're friends. Building the product for yourself, essentially.
Yeah. So that was a nice bonus, I think, that we got to take advantage of. We were in Y Combinator during the winter of 2019, and we started basically, I almost hesitate to even call it beta testing, but like alpha testing a very hacky version of Cocoon with ourselves, with some of our partner at YC. Dalton was, I think he was like the third Cocoon, and he still uses Cocoon to this day with his family and every day. And he's been a really great source of feedback and help. And we've just found more people that like, again, we weren't that unique. We weren't the only ones with family spread out across the country or continent or planet. And this was a pretty universal problem. So we were able to find people. We got tons of feedback. And then we put it in the App Store almost as a onboarding, as a onboarding fix. What I mean by that was when we were in beta and test flight, if someone wanted to create a Cocoon for their family, they had to jump through even more hoops to get that Cocoon started, because they had to get their like parents, who might not be the most tech literate people in the world, to like figure out test flight. At the time, you even had to be on the most recent iOS version. So you had to like update your whole OS just to.
It's a little lengthy onboarding process.
Yeah, it was quite the onboarding process. We're like, okay, we should probably just like put it in the App Store, just so that like people can, we can have a link and that would work. But pretty quickly, we, I think, struck a chord with sort of the zeitgeist. We got a fair bit of press. We were on the Today Show like a few weeks after launch. We were App of the Day a few months later. And so we've had a lot of just like organic traffic from press and content and recognition that I think has driven that first little wave. And I think now we're just starting to think about like, how are people actually finding us if it's not like through one of these sort of one-off moments? And what's been really fascinating is the benefit of having this pool of sort of like family app refugees, if you will, is that these are some of the most like thoughtful and intentional people I've ever met. I spend a lot of time talking to folks like this. I had this amazing chat with this woman yesterday in Charlotte over Zoom, and she had basically, she comes from a family of 10 kids. She just moved to a new city. They had this Facebook group for their family, but some of their family members have kind of quit Facebook. They've got a bunch of nieces and nephews, and she's sort of taken it upon herself to be like, I'm going to find the solution for our family. She did a bunch of research. She's Googling family, social networks, Facebook alternatives, finding like, oh, she had a little spreadsheet of like the handful of ones she wanted to try out. Like, these are people that are so thoughtful and intentional about building a space that is worthy of these relationships, that I think that that's a bit of a wave that we're able to surf on a little bit. And it like killed me actually how hard it was for her to find Cocoon. I think there's enough of sort of like latent demand for something like this that we can try to just fulfill that demand, and that'll get us pretty far. And then I think we'll have to come up with new tricks too. So it's a bit of a constant iteration, I guess, on distribution. But for now, I think that there's a pretty big pull in the market.
Before we wrap up here, I want to just talk a little bit about remote, because if you go on the Cocoon careers page, I think you alluded to essentially when people kind of get back into the office, we hope that everyone will be there. And this is an interesting stance, if you will. Now, obviously, you have a small, tightly knit team, but I'm curious how you looked at this remote wave and whether or not you think in a post-COVID world that is an effective way of running a company.
I think the big important dimension is the stage of your company and what you work on. In our case, as an early stage company, small team, working on a thing that really requires a lot of, we kind of think of Cocoon in some ways as like a constant tweaking of a recipe to try to come up with this. It's almost like this metaphor might be wrong, but like if we are sort of as product designers and builders, sort of like chefs of a meal that you might consume, which I think is a reasonable metaphor.
Yeah.
We're constantly pulling and pushing and tweaking and toggling different ingredients. It's the kind of work that we benefit a lot from in-person time and sort of just like a lot more kind of thinking back to why Cocoon helps families or groups stay close. It's because of this sort of like constant drip of interaction. We kind of benefit a lot from that as well. I don't think that'd be the case if we were building something different. And I don't know if, even if it was the case, if the pros would outweigh the cons, if we were like a 50 person team even, or 100, or let alone 1,000, 10,000, 50,000 person team. So in our case, because we're really small and given what we're working on, I think we benefit a lot from being in person together. We really liked our office. We just really enjoyed getting that time together. However, I don't consider myself sort of like a anti-remote extremist or vice versa at all. I think it's pretty likely that when we go back, we'll try to all be together 2 or 3 days a week. And then we actually used to do a remote day anyways. On Thursdays, we would have everyone would just work from wherever they wanted to. Some people would come to the office. Some people would stay at home. We thought that worked pretty well. It was a good balance. I think you can get 80 or 90% of the value of that in-person interaction without everyone having to commute 9 to 5, 5 days a week kind of thing. So the way we kind of came to this, I think, though, which is what your actual question was sort of just by not listening too much to this whole remote debate became this like huge thing on Twitter. And I talked to a few other founders and CEOs that I know and trust, and just kind of got a pulse on what everyone else was thinking too. We just asked our team kind of what they wanted. We haven't made any decisions yet since we haven't had the opportunity to go back. But my assumption is that when we have the opportunity to go back, we'll probably try to do some sort of hybrid where we're still able to stay at home and work remotely if we want once or twice a week, but where we'd all really value that time together. I think that's you lose something for sure by going full on remote.
Speaking of heated Twitter debates, are you moving to Miami?
No, in fact, I'm doubling down in the Bay Area. I just moved to a new place. My wife and I used to live in Bernal Heights in San Francisco, and we loved it. And now we're a little bit out in the suburbs in San Rafael, a little bit north of the Golden Gate Bridge. And we love it here too. So we're long California and the Bay Area.
Okay. So why is that?
I think it's a few reasons. So one is our community is here for better or for worse. We have a lot of friends and folks who have moved away, but I think there's not like one place that they've all moved to. So like, if I think during COVID, if let's say, I don't know, 50% of our closest friends have dispersed, it's not like they all went to Austin or Miami or wherever. So that doesn't really help at all. And we think a bunch of them maybe would come back. And so for better or for worse, our center of gravity community-wise is here. I think the coming from like growing up in Canada and having done 18 or so of those winters, I think the just natural beauty and geography and weather is a pretty big factor for quality of life for me and for my wife. And she grew up in New York. And so same sort of deal. And we really just love being in California. I think that's one thing that is hard for, not that it's a competition, but when I think about even a place like Miami or Austin or wherever, and those are all fine places, weather-wise, you're not dealing with snowstorms.
SF has better weather.
Yeah, I think like there's just something to be said about that.
I can't stand the heat. That's what I think SF is my favorite climate in the world, probably.
Yeah, me too. I think San Francisco is close to, or we live in Marin County, which is, I think, really does have close to perfect weather. So I value that greatly. And then lastly, I think just the, even beyond our personal friends and family community people here, I do think that this is still a source of, source of talent sounds so like transactional. I think that the Bay Area has proven over a long period of time to sort of just attract a type of person that is super ambitious and interested in working on big problems. And I think that does disperse for sure. Like, I don't think San Francisco is the only place to build a company. I don't think it really, maybe it was more so than it will be, but I do think that that doesn't just go away overnight. So yeah, we like it here.
Mm-hmm. Would you recommend a young person interested in tech and startups, would you recommend they move to San Francisco?
Yeah, I...
Not like this is aimed at anyone, but...
Yeah. I think, as a young person, I would try lots of things, including, I think moving to San Francisco is a very reasonable thing to try. And I really enjoyed spending basically my entire 20s for the most part, just living in San Francisco and meeting tons of people. And there's an energy that I think maybe ebbs and flows. But yeah, I think, if I were in your shoes, maybe right now, or a young person in Canada or wherever, I think I would be super interested in moving out here, trying lots of other places too. I think that did change a little bit 10 years later. Like at the time when I did move down to, it was Palo Alto at the time, it didn't really feel like, okay, am I going to move here or like Austin or Miami or where all these places? Like, there are options, I think. But yeah, I think it's a great place to be.
Mm-hmm. All right. My last question, who are the founders you admire? You know, you're in SF, you kind of, you're in that area around many tech folks, or maybe they're not tech folks. Who are they? Or one, at least one person.
Sure. One person that I've been studying a little bit more on is Toby from Shopify, actually. So not in SF at all, but I think he's done a really good job of everything from first principles. And I had the pleasure of getting to do a little bit of work with Shopify when I was at Facebook and getting to know that team, and super impressed.
Wonderful. Well, Sachin, I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Sachin Manga, one of the ones who succeed. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this show, it would be amazing if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps us out. Or why not tell a friend? That also helps new listeners discover the show. I appreciate it. I'm at Campbell J. Barron on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. So if you want to see and hear what I have to say, you could find me there. If you've made it to the end of the show, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Campbell Barron, and I'll see you next week.